Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, is it time for reparations? And Richard, that is a question that we're hearing more often lately as it begins to circulate amongst the Democratic presidential candidates. Cory Booker has said that he'll file a reparations bill in the Senate, and most of the other Democrats in the race are climbing over each other at the moment to say that they support some version of this, or at least a committee to study it. That's sort of the temporizing position. So Richard, why don't we start with this at a conceptual level? Because, of course, we have a large body of law that deals with compensating people for wrongs. But this is an enormous group of people at a significant historical remove from the affected parties here. So how would a serious attempt at reparations fit into our existing legal framework? Or is this sort of terra incognita?
Well, it's certainly going to be terra incognita, but let us start with the old Aristotelian conception of corrective justice. And it was always a me versus these situation where there was an immediate contact between the two people, no separation by time, no third-party interventions of any sort kind of description is the way in which he puts it when he writes his Nicomachean Ethics. And the basic intuition that he has is corrective justice takes place because I have something of yours, which I've taken, and now what I have to do is to give it back. And what he was thinking about this was in quite heavily concrete terms. So if I take a book from you and keep it on my shelf, corrective justice requires that I return the book. And then you could have all sorts of nice questions about what about interim loss, abuse, damage, and things of that sort. So these immediacy cases essentially are done that way in part because the moral intuitions are very strong, but also in the practical sphere because it turns out the administrative costs are very, very low. The remedy is easy to apply, and the ability to identify who is the wrongdoer and who is the victim is, generally speaking, going to be kind of easy. And so if you go through all of the sort of the classical legal systems, they all have this sort of emphasis upon immediacy of one kind or another. So if you're talking about tort, the definition of trespass is a direct and immediate application of force by one person to another, and you can say bam, and you know exactly what the harm is. With restitution, I happen to take your book, and then I'm required to give it back. So again, you have those kinds of immediacy. The moment you get to the question of reparations over generations and across multitudes of people, I think it's fair to say that you have a very different problem on your hand, and it's not at all clear that the conceptual framework is able to handle it.
Okay, so let me take you to the practical side, because one of the things that one notices about politicians who are pushing this is that they're usually embracing the concept, but there isn't really anyone of any prominence who's willing to get into the details of how this would work. And you argue in your new piece on this at Defining Ideas that if ever there was a case of the devil being in the details, this is it. So explain where the practical difficulties come in.
Well, I mean, the first thing we talked about was immediacy. And it turns out that there are kinds of reparations cases of a political nature that satisfy that condition. The most important of these was the deal worked out quite painfully between the Jewish state of Israel and the German state in 1952-1953, in which there was a very concerted effort to give serious compensation to the few Jewish families who survived. There was no way you could give compensation to families all of whose members were exterminated, and so there was a set of payments that was given to Israel as a kind of a substitute for that in order to help them with the cost of relocation, and that deal lasted for several years. And I think the Germans regarded it as an extremely important thing to enter into that kind of deal because it was the only thing they could do that would get them some cause of finality. And nobody sort of thought about the fact that you can't do perfect matching in this particular case. The size of the German Holocaust is so unimaginably large that it's difficult to think of any practical reason that would prevent you from making a lump sum payment. The other instance that worked pretty well but took a lot longer to execute was the situation with respect to the Japanese internment. The United States, when it did this, had all sorts of establishment people who were in favor of the internment of the Japanese. If you go look at the list of people who supported it, it's quite astonishing. Herbert Wechsler, one of the great criminal law professors of the mid-century, was actually the guy who argued the case for the government. And you had eminent justices like Hugo Black, who wrote the opinion, Felix Frankfurt, and a number of other people who did it. Earl Warren was very active in this as Attorney General of the state of New York. And the whole thing was a moral horror show from one end to another. There was no cause for what the imprisonment was. And in effect, the only reason they would let people out was to fight. And many of the Nisei, that is the Japanese Americans, fought in very large numbers with immense distinction in the European theater. And by 1988, after Fred Korematsu had lost his case in 1944, Congress decides that it would give only to survivors, not to their descendants, a relatively small sum of then $20,000, which was several billion dollars when you total all the people who had been suffered to this thing, in an effort to try to close this. But again, it was a delay in time, but there was no question about who was the wrongdoer, I think, and there was no question about who was the victim, and there was no effort to try and give it to people who in some sense count as descendants of the other individuals. The moment you steal with reparations, you could go into the details, but two facts immediately start to leap out on these things. One is that the slavery ended in 1865. Jim Crow starts up mainly in the late 1880s, early 1990s. It ends by 1954, but it's a long and arduous roll from there. But you've got seven generations, and you've got thousands of complications that take place in the interim period, including efforts to suppress black interests, which were terrible and horrible in the worst possible way. And I think the saddest thing is that many of the progressives who champion reparations are, in fact, supportive of legislation which hurts the cause of the very people whom they want to champion. The progressives will favor the union over black school children. One wants vouchers, one wants charter schools, the other does not. And you know who has won that battle. You put in place legislation like minimum wage laws. Even the anti-discrimination laws, in the end, don't help. The only president who has done something which has actually worked for the benefit of back workers in recent years has been Donald Trump, because of indifference. And he says, I'm not going to enforce any of this stuff. And things that were thought to be assistance turned out to be barriers to entry. And if you look at the market, the wages of minorities, the wages of children, the wages of criminals have all moved up more rapidly than the general wage structure over the last several years. So, you know, who is responsible for what when you have all these interim policies becomes a long-standing nightmare. You could go into them quite literally one by one.
So calling on the concrete examples that you cited a moment ago, Richard, play out this thought experiment for me. If we were talking about the same sorts of compensatory remedies in terms of reparations, everything's the same, except the year is 1866, right after the end of the Civil War. Is your view on this different?
One of the difficulties you could see about figuring out who wears the black hats and who wears the white hats, who's the good guys and the bad guy, is to think of various kinds of protective legislation, including the passage of the anti-discrimination laws, most notably in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Now, some of these provisions were unambiguously important and extremely helpful. I think that could be said with virtually all of the early voting rights reform, which started to give African-American citizens a much more powerful say in local politics. When it comes to public accommodations, I think that by and large this turned out to be fairly successful as well, knocking down the residual barriers in the South. But if you start looking at things like employment, it turns out it's much more complicated. It's very difficult to find a positive relationship between the enforcement of the civil rights laws and employment discrimination and overall levels of black participation and black wages. So what does one make of all of this? As you know, I have been consistently an opponent of Title VII, thinking that it has no place in competitive markets. Am I a good guy or a bad guy? Or the people who favor the statute, which turns out, as I believe to be the case, unproductive, are they the good guys or the bad guys? So what happens is you have a very fractionated American public on all sorts of issues. Some people pushing very hard for the Democratic agenda, for the civil rights agenda. Some people pushing very hard against it. But it's many of us who were pushing very hard against the civil rights agenda did so because we thought it was counterproductive. And so you then have the question, are people who were trying to do their very level best in the last 50 years, whatever side they're taking, are these the people whom you wish to target in order to fund the reparations program? This is not funding the Nazi government like it was in 1945. You have just this huge ebb and flow, and if you allow people to individually opt out of this system, the whole thing breaks down. If you decide that everybody has to go in, it's going to be catastrophic. aspect. If you do this in terms of individual reparations, assuming who you know whom you want it to be, you're talking about trillions of dollars. There is not enough political support in this system to reach that conclusion, because outside of the echo chambers of the Democratic Party and the Civil Rights Movement, probably 65 to 70% of Americans are opposed to the program in the way in which it's been proposed, even if you're thinking about this in terms of a civil rights commission rather than in terms of a concrete answer.
Is there a reasonable distinction by which one can be in favor of reparations for African Americans and not for Native Americans, or does one necessitate the other?
Well, that is a great question to ask. And, you know, I've been very heavily involved in a large number of questions associated with pipelines and so forth. And my general position is actually contrary to what people might think, is Aboriginal rights being first possession rights are kind of Lockean rights, and I'm fairly sympathetic to them. And people were forcibly displaced from their lands, maybe with cause, maybe not. Sometimes there were treaties that resulted in the transfer of land. Sometimes there were aggressive wars against white settlers that may have provoked these reactions. You put people on reservations. There's no question that there is a huge simmering resentment on the part of many tribes who think that they have been badly treated throughout history. And there's a lot of stuff that you can say that in general can support these particular claims. But then your question is, well, what do you do afterwards to try to help things? So you pass a whole variety of legislation that is intended to help and target Indian communities. Sometimes it's by way of subsidies. Sometimes it's by way of trying to preserve various forms of historical monuments. Sometimes it's by giving them privileges to hold casinos and things of that sort, which other people cannot do. It's the respect of Indian sovereignty. That story is every bit as complicated as the other story. And my own view about it is, again, I don't see how reparations are going to solve any problem. They will just create new anxieties. What you try to do is, if you see some structural flaw in the current operation of the system, you try to fix that in some sensible way. The difficulty you get with that is we've done a lot of these structural fixes. And so the question is, well, can you do the next time for an encore? But if you do this for the Indian tribes, then you're going to have exactly the same question. What do you do about the Chinese exclusion laws? What do you do about the various discriminations that the KKK perpetuated, often with government assistance in connection with Roman Catholics and with Jews in the United States? We become a nation of victims. And I think by and large, the better thing to do is we have to acknowledge the past, recognize that many things happened that none of us are particularly proud of, to understand that the United States was not unique in this particular situation. There was black-on-black slavery. There was Indian-on-Indian slavery. It turns out anytime you have two groups who have different sentiments and different ethnic identities, in an earlier age, they could engage in conquest and slavery, and it didn't matter what the race or religion of these particular organizations were. And I think you want to make sure that nobody forgets this. So one of the things that has been proposed, and which I have some more sympathy, is the statement of an apology that was part of the situation that went forward with respect to Japanese internment in 1988. They apologized for the actions that had taken place 44 years ago. If somebody wants to do that for slavery, I think you have to be very careful in the way in which you word this so you don't make it appear as though every American was supportive of slavery. But it was institutionalized in some but not all parts of the United States, and there were many people who heroically fought to end it. The Civil War was largely fought over slavery, even though there were other economic issues. I think you could try to work that out, but it's going to be very hard. The precedent on that, of course, would be with respect to apartheid in South Africa and the change in control in 1994 when Nelson Mandela took over. And they did have the commission dealing with truth and reconciliation. One could try that, but I have to say, ending apartheid in 1994 left you a lot more to do in 1995 than ending slavery and Jim Crow did many, many years ago. So it's not at all clear that there's any perfect historical analogy to all of this stuff. What I'm worried about is that I think the claims that are put are so strident and so emphatic and so one-sided that many of the people who are in favor of these things just don't want to listen to any of the practical difficulties that come on the other side. And one of the ironies is we have probably, I think, in many ways, worse race relations that we had now than we had 10 years ago. I think much of the decline takes place under Donald Trump, but I would not want to rule out the period of uneasiness under Barack Obama, where there were a large number of killings that took place, terrible incidents with respect to Michael Brown and Trayvon Martin and all this other stuff. So there's enough blame to go around on everybody. And if it turns out that everybody has to be responsible to everybody, then the best thing you can do is to try to get the books right going forward. I don't think that making transfer payments in order to rectify what happens in the past is likely to do any good, and it may exacerbate old wounds, old tensions, and deepen all too powerful resentments that we now see throughout the country.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.